This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello, and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and all over the world, we're told, accessing the show on the internet. We have two studio guests this week, Charles Thompson and Peter Symes. Charles Thompson is going to tell us about his experiences as a sports journalist at weekends in London and Kent, and Peter Symes is going to discuss documentaries and documentary making. Our features this week are by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling. We have some music composed by Howard Davidson from Bath. He recently composed the music for Leonard Cohen's poem, The Guests, which was performed in Bristol Cathedral to mark the 65th commemoration of the liberation of Auschwitz, the 27th of January 1945. Malcolm Greaves, as ever, reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A.L. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. We're hoping to speak later in the show to Stephen Williams, the Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West, live from Westminster. Trevor Carter, our resident bard, is here to read his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'd like to introduce our first guest to the studio, Mr. Charles Thompson. Hello.
Hello, John. It's a pleasure to be here. Fantastic.
Excellent. So tell me a little bit about your career as a sports journalist. How long ago did this start? And
This happened in the 80s when I was living in London. I was teaching in London, and I formed a sports programme on the Charing Cross Hospital Radio, and we went down to Fulham and did commentaries, and we decided to go further afield, and so we had press passes for almost every football ground in London, which is a bit cheeky, but yeah. there were people in the hospital that really wanted to hear about their team. So we also had cricket grounds and all sorts of things, even a Wimbledon pass at one time. So it was a fantastic experience for us, and I think that the patients really enjoyed it. And then we joined a press agency, and we got work with people who wanted a reporter in London. Perhaps BBC Radio Lancashire, Blackpool, was coming down, and they wanted someone to report on Brentford v Blackpool. So we'd go along and do all that sort of thing for them. So I've done a lot of football reports, and later on a few cricket reports and things. And it was a fantastic little part-time hobby that complemented my main job, which was teaching in a comprehensive school.
Okay, yeah, I imagine you probably need to de-stress a bit after...
I like teaching in a comprehensive school, but you need to do something different. And it was a wonderful challenge to go and report on football matches, because you had to speak succinctly, clearly, enthusiastically, colourfully, and just for 30 or 40 seconds every quarter of an hour. It was a wonderful challenge. And of course, you imagined you're going to be like Stuart Hall, but you're never quite like him. But it was a great thing to do.
I was going to say, did you have any particular heroes that you looked up to and thought, you know, I'm really going to follow this guy's commentary? This guy's
well, Stuart Hall is unparalleled. He is absolutely marvellous, because he can talk for 45 seconds and give the story of a Shakespeare play and a football report at the same time. And the way he used to call Graham Souness Caesar, of course, is absolutely marvellous. But he does it all the time, and it's incredibly colourful. I feel very sorry for the guy who comes afterwards. He's going to spout a whole load of clichés, and when you spout a whole load of clichés after someone who's treated you to a creative writing exercise, it's very difficult. But he still rules the roost as the great football reporter. Yeah. They're all great on the beat. They're all great. They're all wonderful. They all speak with knowledge, passion, effortlessly. And there are two types. One is the guy who just describes colourfully, and the other's the expert. You know, they'll have Mark Lawrenson, and they'll have someone like Mike Ingham. And the two things go wonderfully together. But that's always been the case. You know, John Arlott, and I don't think Geoffrey Boycott ever did work with John Arlott. There's always a guy who describes it colourfully, and the guy who's the expert.
Yeah. What have you thought about the way football's changed a lot over the past? It's changed a lot over the past 20 years.
Well, when I used to report, the football teams were very from the area, a lot of them mostly, and community, and not it wasn't a huge industry. It was an industry, and there weren't a huge amount of people from overseas. But now, of course, you get a team like Arsenal without any local players at all, which in a way is fantastic entertainment. But something has been lost. You know, the days when Jimmy Greaves used to catch the bus to Spurs, and the footballers would sit in the pubs and have a chat with people and stuff. Those days have gone, and those days were fantastic. And I was a reporter in those days. Yeah. Mm. But they have gone. But other things have come in their stead. And of course, the money is just extraordinary.
Yeah. Well, what did you do then when you were reporting on? Did you go along with the recorder and sort of record action, or did you basically just?
I went along to a match and I had to do a preview on the phone. So someone would ring me up and say, "I'm giving you a program." They'd play some music or something, and then they'd introduce me, and I gave a preview. And then every 15 minutes, I would give a little report of what was happening.
Okay,
40 seconds a report, and then I'd round off at the end. You know. I had to do something like this. I'll just do a little imitation of a report. Okay, right? Are you ready for this?
Okay. I am, yes. Give it.
Okay. 50 minutes gone here at the Priestfield Stadium. It's Brentford 2, Gillingham 0. And what a cracking start to the game. Higginbotham got down the right in the first minute and crossed. And there was Jones to power home the header with Green stranded. 10 minutes later, it was Jones returning the compliment, crossing from the left, and a little header past again the stranded goalkeeper. It's great entertainment. Gill's fans are absolutely wild. 15 minutes gone. Gillingham 2, Brentford 0.
Fantastic.
That's what I had to do every 15 minutes. Yeah. It's quite difficult to do. You don't want to speak too fast.
Yeah.
You know, you've got to speak clearly.
You've got to get it all in.
I mean, my first report, I got more and more nervous as I went along. I was doing it for LBC. I got more and more nervous, and I couldn't read my writing. And I couldn't read who the second goal was scored by. So I said, "And the second goal was scored by," and I just picked out a name. Jones. It was the wrong name. And two fans were listening to me and they tapped me on the shoulder after and said, "Hey, lad, you messed that one up, didn't you?" But, you know, you live and learn. And it was a great experience. And I met some fantastic people.
Yeah.
For instance, Brian Clough. We had loads of people on our show. We just rang them up and said, "Would you do Hospital Radio?" And they will, because they're charitable people, compassionate people. Brian Clough was on our programme before an FA Cup semi-final, and someone called Derek was interviewing him, and he and Derek said a football question, and Brian Clough suddenly said, "Excuse me, Derek, are you married?"
Yes.
And Derek was completely nonplussed. He wasn't at the time, he is now. And Brian Clough said, "Well, you should be, lad. Cornerstone of your life." You know, and this extraordinary sort of personality suddenly bursting into football with his gnomic wisdom about, but this is incredibly genuine, you know, and it was wonderful. These great characters. And I must just tell you one story about another great character. I went up to Yorkshire to do some work for Radio Pennine Radio, FM station, and I had to go to Halifax to interview the manager, Billy Ayres. It was just tough little Scots bloke, and I thought I'd be clever and ask him a difficult question. I said, "Billy," it was at Christmas time, I said, "Billy, the fans are giving you some stick. What's your message for them?" There was a sort of 3-second pause, and he said, "Happy New Year," which was a wonderful thing to say, because he just shoved all that stuff away.
I'm going to completely ignore your question.
Toughly. And there were some... They're great, great characters.
Okay. Have you fallen out of the practice of doing it these days, or are you still doing it?
When I came to Bristol, I stopped doing it. I concentrated on my teaching, what I did, and poetry and other things. So I finished my career in Kent.
Well, there's always time for you here, you see. There's always a community for registration here. There's also listenership. And I'm very impressed. So consider that your interview. You've passed.
Oh, right. Thank you very much.
Well, Charles Thompson, thank you very much for coming in. Before we move on to our next guest, Peter Symes, we're going to hear one of the many pieces of music composed by Bath composer Howard Davidson, and hopefully we'll be playing more of these in the coming weeks. was local composer Howard Davidson. Peter Symons is our next guest. Hello, welcome to the Dalek Studio.
Very nice to be here.
So, you are a documentary maker.
I am indeed. I joined the BBC in 1970, and I've spent most of my career working with documentaries and documentary filmmakers. But I left the BBC 10 years ago and to do two things, really, to do more freelance work. And I work with a local company called Available Light, who do a lot of very interesting work. They've just had a very interesting series transmitted called Shooting the War, which is about the home movies that Germans and British families shot. And it's a combination of the two in each programme. Very interesting mixture. So it's sort of the war from the home front.
Yeah.
So I do that. But the other thing that I got involved with was a thing called the Documentary Campus, which is a very interesting initiative based in Munich. And what it's set up to do is to encourage really established filmmakers who have got a reputation in their own country, to look beyond their national borders.
Okay.
And it's a big EU-funded operation. Okay. And the idea is you get people from all over Europe, they come to Munich, and they come with a project. So we take 16 projects every year, we workshop them, and at the end of the year, they should be up to speed in order to raise the money from across Europe to make that programme.
Okay, and then how are they released to the public?
And then they're either released, they're usually released, they have a cinema release very often, or they're, and they're on DVD, of course, as well. Everyone does that too. But they usually have at least two or three broadcast releases. So they might have a broadcast in France, a broadcast in Germany, a broadcast in the UK. They might even, on a couple of occasions, have a US broadcast.
Yeah.
We've had some successes over in the United States.
Oh, fantastic.
And we've got our first Oscar nomination this year, with a short documentary nomination, under the short documentary nominations, and it's called Rabbit a la Berlin.
Okay, and what happens in this?
Well, it's a very interesting film. It's a couple of Polish filmmakers, crazy Polish filmmakers, and they wanted to make a film about the Berlin Wall. And they started researching it and looking into the story, and they discovered that, of course, the only folk who really enjoyed the wall were the rabbits who lived in the no man's land between the two walls.
Right.
Okay.
Okay.
And of course, when the wall came down, it was hell for the rabbits because, you know, suddenly their beautiful, peaceful no man's land was invaded. So they take that as a metaphor, a very clever idea to look at the whole issue. And they looked at the whole issue of East and West through that perspective. And it's a very clever film.
Excellent.
Clever film.
So how did you find working for the BBC, and how did you find working on sort of projects that you want to do outside of the BBC?
Well, I mean, the BBC, I had a very wonderful career at the BBC. I was very lucky because I came down to Bristol, and actually I came to Bristol at a time in the late 80s, early 90s, when it was absolutely booming. So we had a great time, and we did all sorts of crazy things. You know, we made films about the history of false teeth, and we made films with verse commentaries, and we did all sorts of wonderful things like that. Which would be very difficult to do now, I think, very difficult.
Yeah.
But when I moved out, we took a bit of that to companies like Available Light. I mean, one of the things that we've been developing with Available Light is the whole use of home movies.
Yeah.
We did another series about the history of farming recently called Mud, Sweat and Tractors.
Okay.
And that was the 20th century farming story, but told using individual farmers' home movies, which is a very interesting new way of looking at history, and it was very interesting.
Like you're increasingly finding the more creative stuff is outside of sort of traditional.
Well, we're trying to.
BBC
we're trying to. Yeah.
Guidelines.
I mean, I'm a trustee of something called the Grierson Trust, which is a trust that was a charity set up to commemorate John Grierson, who's the founder of British documentary. And we have a big award ceremony every year, which awards, I would say, the traditional media.
Mm-hmm.
Documentaries in the traditional media. So it's the
Does that mean? Just
the David Attenboroughs, the you know, the big documentary histories, the major investigative work, etc.
Yeah.
And increasingly, we've become dissatisfied with that, and we will carry on, obviously, doing that because that's one of our big remits. But we're now looking at, to see whether we can't offer a platform and reward the work, the very interesting work that's being done in the community.
Okay.
And I'll give you one example I've just come across recently of a young lad down here in the southwest who's just done four films with dementia patients where he gave the camera to the patient to make the little documentaries. Now, that's something that's completely, you know, there's no one knows about it. There's not much publicity about this. It's done for a very small group of people, perhaps for a charity or something like that. But I think that's something that we should be looking at, and we should be rewarding, and we should be bringing these communities together in some way. Yeah. So we want to provide a platform, a central platform, through our website, through some of the events that we can organise in London and elsewhere, of course.
That's a good point, because the increase in technology means that a lot of documentaries and films may not necessarily be made for TV.
Absolutely.
There's hundreds of other purposes.
Absolutely. Yeah. Absolutely. If you're a documentary filmmaker now, you can make anything you like. You've got the technology available, and you should really think about the fact that the market is out there. Mm. You can do it yourself, and you can get it out there if you want to.
Okay, how successful have you been so far in trying to reach out?
Well, we haven't started yet. This is a new initiative.
A new initiative.
You hear it first time tonight.
Yeah.
We're still planning on how to do it. We're talking to all the different people, the Media Trust and First Light and these other big charities that support these sort of initiatives in the community.
Okay.
And keep your eyes open, and hopefully we'll have something up and running soon.
Okay, well, tell me a little bit briefly about John Grierson. You described him as the father of British documentary.
Yeah, well, John Grierson was a very famous documentary filmmaker in his own right. His first famous film called Drifters, 1929.
Right.
So it goes back a long way.
Yeah.
He then set up a unit which became very famous. It was started as the GPO unit. Post Office, made a film called Night Mail, which everyone knows, with Auden and Britten doing the commentary in verse and the music.
Okay.
And then he went on in the war to run a very successful operation with filmmakers like Humphrey Jennings, Harry Watt and people like that, Basil Wright, making documentaries for the war effort. And after the war, he found it very difficult to get funding. Funding suddenly stopped. So he went over to Canada, and they funded him to set up the National Film Board in Canada.
Right,
so he's as famous in Canada as he is, hopefully, in the UK.
Excellent. So how do you think, do you think hopefully in the future some kind of funding or resource structure might come into place in theory for, an awful lot of local filmmakers who, the BBC are probably not really going to be interested in?
No, I mean, there are quite good funding structures around. Things like First Light and stuff for the young filmmakers, anyone under 19, have got some good resources out there if they care to look around.
Okay, so people out there listening, bear this in mind.
Yeah, but we're hoping to encourage everyone, and I'd just be just as happy to have a pensioner come in and get some funding to make a film as I would for a 16-year-old.
Yeah, okay. Well, excellent. Well, Grierson, the Grierson Trust, is a good place to start if you want to find out a little bit more, but I'll spell that for you. Grierson is Grierson. And if you Google the Grierson Trust, then you will find out more. And thank you very much for coming in.
Lovely. Thank you for having me.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's interviews with two students from the Bristol University Islamic Group. And it's about Discover Islam Week, an exhibition and a series of talks held this week to bring awareness of Islam and what it means to the general public.
My name is Mahmoud, and we are in Wales Memorial Building, and we have here an exhibition called Exhibition Islam. It introduces Islam and through different topics, through posters and artifacts as well.
Can you tell us about the special week?
Yeah, every year the Islamic Society of University of Bristol, which is a student society, we have an event at similar time in February, talking about just introducing Islam, what's about Islam, to clear the misconceptions that we found here in the minds of different people here. So basically we had an exhibition and we have a series of talks. These talks started on the 1st of February and will end on the 9th of February. These talks cover different topics. The first one was about the essence of Islam. The second talk was sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It's concentrated on explaining the way of life we are living, which is very materialistic, and how Islam look at this type of life, and what kind of life Muslims, what is the way of life Muslims are living.
My name is Emmanuel Thomas Johnson, and I'm the president of the Bristol University Islamic Society. I'm currently 24 years old, and I'm studying theology, final year student actually. I've been heavily involved in the Islamic Society and in this Discover Islam Week, which is a 9-day event aimed to present Islam to those interested.
Can you tell us about the reaction of the public to this week?
I think we've had a very positive reaction. The exhibition opened today, but we've seen many people come, you know, from the general public come into the exhibition, which is quite good, because sometimes university events can seem quite kind of student only, or maybe not very friendly to a public to come in as well. But there's been a very good reaction, and many people have come in and asked questions, and you know, we've conversed and got to know a great deal as well.
Some people may have misconceptions about Islam. How do you think the exhibition has changed their view?
I mean, the exhibition, I think, has been good in that it's presented many of the quote-unquote contentious, controversial, and quite contemporary topics which people have in their minds about Islam, or people unsure about, you know, things about the Quran, things about Muhammad, etc., etc. Furthermore, the exhibition has been able to go further and give people an understanding of, you know, the Quran and science, for example, something which is not known at all. Also about, you know, the tolerance within Islam, justice, the status of women.
Was it true that Muhammad was at the forefront of women's liberation?
Prophet Muhammad, he came to a society where the female infanticide was quite prevalent, and the tribesmen at the time would bury their daughters for fear that they couldn't provide or maybe be worthy to be provided for by them. Furthermore, it was customary at the time for men to have very many, you know, a multitude of wives, and to divorce them and, you know, have no way of actually looking after them afterwards. Muhammad and the revelation of the Quran, they were able to actually change this. They were to limit the amount of wives a man was allowed to have to four. They were to give women incredible rights, in that the husband was now compelled to look after his wife, to provide for his wife, and to treat her in a special kind of way. And we really see this embodied in Muhammad himself and his treatment towards his own wives, where, you know, they were treated with the utmost respect. They were seen as, you know, the mothers of the believers, and, you know, they would really be at the forefront in some ways of some of the, you know, discussions and the debates around the early Muslim community. It's a beautiful time for women's liberation.
So what other things about Muhammad do you think have surprised people?
The general humanity of Muhammad is something which people have often overlooked. And too often we only hear about, you know, we see him as some sort of, people view him as some sort of warlord or some sort of, you know, deviant prophet or whatever. But I think people have come to realise that actually he stood for justice, and he stood for honesty, and he stood for all that was good. And that he really had a massive impact, you know, on humankind in such a positive way.
Can you tell us a bit about the Quran?
Okay. I mean, the Quran was Allah's, or God's, revelation to Muhammad. And not only was it a revelation in order to guide Muhammad and to help him through the many tests and tribulations and trials which he encountered, but it was also there in order to guide humanity as well. The Quran is a book which has come at the end of a succession of other books, which included the Torah and included the Gospels. And it is God's definitive communication to mankind, for mankind to follow. It is the final testament, you could say, of God's will. And Muslims hold it to be the direct words of God, in that they have not been changed since their revelation to Muhammad, which is something really unique to the Quran. The language of the Quran is Arabic as well, and it is actually preserved in the minds and the hearts of millions of Muslims worldwide, who actually take the time to actually learn the entire Quran. It's a 400-page book, which is really quite a feat. I mean, the Quran is a book of guidance, as I said before, and Muslims do their best, their utmost, to base their lives on the precepts of the Quran. It's a book which can be understood on various different levels. I mean, Muslims five times a day, if they cannot understand Arabic, and would recite the Quran in their prayers. Some would possibly sit down and study the Quran, reflect on its meanings, thereby gain a spiritual connection with their Creator.
What does the Quran say about punishment for crimes?
In the Quran, the punishment for crimes, is seen as something to, in order to deter people away from committing crimes. Things like theft, things like murder are punishable quite severely. This cannot be divorced from the entire Islamic system of justice. The Quran's laws are God's laws, and that He has given us these laws for a reason, and that despite them might be, you know, they might be harsh to the untrained mind, they're there in order to deter people from it, from violating these laws. But they're ultimately just. I mean, as believers in the afterlife, Muslims, we hold that for someone to be punished in this life for a crime they committed will actually help them to not be punished for it in the afterlife. The afterlife is an eternal punishment for those who transgress certain laws or rights of others. I would just like to sum up by saying that, I mean, this exhibition is a really incredible opportunity for anyone, Muslims, non-Muslims, anyone interested, to really envelop their understanding of Islam. And this comes at a critical time when we're seeing laws passed throughout Europe, where we're seeing curtailment of civil liberties, where we're seeing various other things which have been blamed on Islam and the demonization of Muslims. And this is obviously a unique opportunity to actually understand what the religion is actually all about.
Thank you to Anthony Page for that feature on Bristol University's Discover Islam Week. A short piece of music now. This is a track by an album by Bristol artist, singer and guitarist Diane Johnston. This track is called When Day Is Done, from her debut CD, The Troubled Heart, which was launched at the Jazz at Future Dates venue last Wednesday.
I walked with you and talked with you. I heard your words and they rang true. We started out with nothing and we ended with a song. I heard you sing, I saw you dance. You made this world a better place. The best of it, the pieces fit, and it made perfect sense. I just want to dance forever in the sun. I just want to hold you close when day is done. When day is done.
That was Bristol's very own Diana Johnston singing When Day Is Done. You may well have missed it, but at the end of last year, Jack Straw decided that magistrates would no longer have to declare their membership of the Freemasons' secret society when applying to join the bench. Unsurprisingly, this hasn't made the Daily Press very much. Originally, in incoming Labour government, they made the Declaration of Masonic Interests compulsory in 1998. So what has changed and why? Jerry Coulter is a victim of Masonic corruption, and Dialect's Tony Gosling asked him what he discovered about what professions the Masons inhabit.
Certainly in your local council, you'll probably find them in the police force, you'll find them in other areas of public office. The legal profession is particularly one that they gravitate towards, and also we're very, very concerned about, as I say, the magistrates and the judiciary. Basically what we used to call circuit judges or district judges, that kind of thing, that have come up through the ranks of the legal profession, and now these people are adjudicating. They're on a bench, and these people should be, the public should have confidence that they're getting a fair hearing, not that these people could be swayed by membership of an organisation.
So if you see a judge or a magistrate in court, how do you know whether they're a Freemason or not?
Unfortunately, you don't. And once upon a time, you would have been able to ask them to declare whether they were. But unfortunately, it's not been reported in the press much. There was a few, last month, which was overshadowed with Christmas, and there was a slight smattering in the press that Jack Straw has actually made it so that magistrates and judges do not have to declare membership of Freemasonry. And this has been foisted on us because of a EU ruling. In Italy,
which is, of course, a very uncorrupt country.
Yeah, well, we've had P2 Lodge and all sorts of things
and
going on.
Mafia,
with, and
course,
the mafia. Yeah. And P2 Lodge, of course, is, and the politics in Italy were all tied in with the mafia. Anyway, they in Italy, a judge, I think it was a circuit judge, he took a case to the European Court of Human Rights and won. Basically, that he said that under the article, which was freedom of association, he was being discriminated against and his human rights were abused, and the European Court of Human Rights agreed with him. Well, I fail to see how freedom of association and his position of a judge, where there's a conflict of interest with Freemasonry, could fit the bill that somehow his human rights were being abused. Because if he wanted to, no one's saying you can't be a Freemason. So freedom of association he had. You could be a Freemason. But in the public interest, you shouldn't be a Freemason if you're a judge, because there's always this element of doubt and this whole thing about public interest that you could abuse that position.
But I mean, even if you were, say, for example, the head of a golf club, you could abuse your position as a councillor or as a policeman, couldn't you?
Well, this is one of the things that I've always said. I mean, in Dorset, there was a case. I don't know if I should be naming names, but the most powerful Freemason in Dorset, the provincial Grand Master, was a JP. He sat on the bench and he heard evidence from a PC, a Dorset policeman. This case you can read on my website at www.dorsetvictimsupport.org, Victim Stories. It's also on Mason's Corner of my website. And the provincial Grand Master of Dorset knew that he should not have taken evidence from the policeman who was a member of his same lodge, 3366 Dorset Master Masons Lodge, because they knew each other through Freemasonry. Now, if you take Freemasonry out of that equation, if that magistrate was a member of Dorchester Swimming Club, and he knew that PC just to nod at or maybe have a drink with at the bar after swimming, that is enough for him to stand himself down. People have been let out of prison for less, right? That case was flawed because the victim, a man named Barry Hunt, I will name the victim in this case, right? And Barry Hunt's case is on this website that I've just said, dorsetvictimsupport.org. He always maintained that the police officer involved was giving perjured evidence against him to that bench. And that magistrate naturally ruled in favour of the police officer. And magistrates will gravitate towards listening to police officers anyway, because they always take it that the policeman is telling the correct things to the court and that he can't possibly be lying. All right. So that is the first issue, even if Freemasonry wasn't involved. But in this case, that magistrate had taken an oath to defend a brethren at all costs, a brother Mason. That is what, this is their oath, that I will build a column of defence and I will defend a brother Mason at all costs. When they're sworn in at the very lowest level of Freemasonry, when they're first sworn in and initiated as what's called the initiated apprentice, right, they put their hand in the Master Mason's hand and they give that oath. So, therefore, that magistrate, who was the provincial Grand Master, who knew that police officer through Freemasonry, should have stood himself down. He knew he should have done that. Under the magistrate's rules, he had to.
But I mean, is there any penalty in law for that sort of transgression?
Yeah, it was misfeasance. It was misconduct in public office. He knew he should have stepped away from that, and he didn't. He heard that case, and then he ruled against Mr. Hunt. And that by doing so, he committed a prima facie criminal offence himself. Because he took evidence from someone that he knew and he did not stand himself down.
Is there any evidence of Freemasons being involved at the highest levels of the judiciary in cases like the Birmingham Six and the Guildford Four? Because these are very famous miscarriages of justice.
Most certainly there is. Commander George Churchill Coleman was the head of the anti-terrorist squad at the time. If you go to my website at www.dorsetvictimsupport.org and you go to Freemasons, you go to Mason's Corner, you will find a newspaper cutting, PDF'd up there, where it exposes the Lodge Manor of St. James, which is the Scotland Yard Lodge. And it exposes George Churchill Coleman as being one of the members of that lodge. And they kept those people, the Guildford people, they kept those people in prison for 14 years, knowing they were innocent, until the likes of George Churchill Coleman and others had policemen, some that were incumbent in the anti-terrorist squad at the time, that were being fast-tracked for promotion elsewhere, to allow them to complete their police careers or retire and get their pensions.
That was Victim of the Freemasons, Jerry Coulter, talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling, and his websites again are policeinefficiency.com and dorsetpolice.com. Next week, Jerry will be explaining about Masonic lodges in Westminster and at Scotland Yard and giving details of Masonic handshakes and secret code words. We go over to Westminster now to talk to Bristol West's Liberal Democrat MP, Stephen Williams.
Well, I'd like to introduce on the line now Stephen Williams from Westminster. Hello.
Hello there.
So tell me a little bit about how Liberal Democrats are gearing up for the election, which we assume is going on May the 6th. Are you pretty hopeful for better results?
I think I'm very optimistic for the party nationally and in the greater Bristol area as well. Obviously, the West Country has been a strong area for the Liberal Democrats now for most of the last decade, and I think we'll be successful in holding on to our seats and maybe even gain a few. But around the country, we're hopeful of picking up quite a lot of seats, in particular from the Labour Party.
Okay, I mean, do you think you're making the party is making the best possible use of obviously the fact that it might be a hung parliament in this election? How do you think the Liberal Democrats are going to handle that?
We'll have to wait and see. I mean, we can't guess what the electorate are going to do. The people haven't spoken yet, so we'll have to wait and see what the outcome of the election is, and then have a discussion about it.
Right, OK. I mean, what do you think you would do? I mean, presumably there would be offers. The word coalition is inevitably going to come up in the result of the hung parliament.
Yes, well, I mean, plenty of countries around the world, certainly many of our European neighbours, get by with coalition government, Germany being the obvious example. And, of course, in local government up and down the country, coalitions are quite common.
Who do you think you would...
Most of our major cities, Birmingham, Leeds... and many others have coalitions or cross-party deals, so it's not as if it's a revolutionary thing. Yeah. But I think it would be quite a culture shock for Westminster.
Yes, I think it probably would. Who do you think? Who do you think you fancy you might wind up siding with? I mean, do you think Labour or Conservative?
Well, I don't think at February, a few months before the election itself, is the right moment to be speculating on what might happen after the election.
Okay, fair enough.
That's why we need to focus on what the Liberal Democrats are offering during the election itself, which are fair taxes, smaller class sizes, extra investment for children from poorer families, green new jobs, and cleaning up politics, which I think will appeal to a lot of people at the moment when, to be honest, I think Parliament is pretty discredited.
OK. I mean, what about electoral reform? Because 13 years into New Labour's reign, Gordon Brown has suddenly brought up electoral reform somewhat to the last minute. I imagine the Liberal Democrats are delighted, aren't you?
Well, the reform that Gordon Brown is proposing, the alternative vote, is a step forward. It's better than the existing first-past-the-post system, which is a terribly discredited system now. But it's only a minor improvement, really. A fully proportional system where people's votes actually get reflected in the distribution of members of Parliament would be our preference. But what we are going to be supporting is a referendum on a change in the voting system. Unfortunately, the only option the Labour government are giving us is something they call the alternative vote, mm-hmm. which means you'd rank candidates in order of preference, but just in a single member seat. That's better than the existing system, but it's not as far as we'd like to go.
OK, so you're pleased, but only to a certain degree.
Yes, that's mm-hmm. right. But to be honest, it's pretty much a deathbed conversion. From the Labour Party. I mean, they promised a referendum on proportional representation in their 1997 general election manifesto, and it's 13 years later. They didn't feel able to deliver that when they had a large majority in 1997. Suddenly, when the sort of sands of time are running out for them and it looks as though they're going to be defeated at the election, they've had a deathbed conversion.
OK. In terms of the recession of recent years, I mean, Vince Cable has come out looking quite credible in analysing the problems that have led up to it. But what are you going to do to get us out of it? If you were in government.
It is important to recognise that Vince Cable and the Liberal Democrats did correctly predict that the credit boom was not sustainable and was bound to burst at some point. I can recall when I was first elected as Bristol West MP back in 2005 that Labour MPs used to laugh whenever Vince Cable made these remarks.
But what is the Lib Dem strategy to get us out of it?
The first thing is to fix the banking system. Of course, Vince has been putting forward solutions for having more control over the banks, which have now largely and belatedly been adopted by the government. The people who've really suffered so far, though, in the recession are young people. That's quite different from earlier recessions that I've experienced in my life, when the recession's been pretty evenly distributed. But perhaps older workers have felt the brunt more. This particular recession has hit young people much more hard than previous recessions. So our priority is to put measures in place to get young people into education and training and work opportunities, rather than their first experience of what should be their working life when they leave school or college.
Yeah.
Is the dole queue, which unfortunately is a sad experience of tens of thousands of people at the moment.
Okay, in short, so to sum up, just sort of last question, if you had, one short sentence to say to voters, this is why you should vote for me, what are the Lib Dems about? What are Stephen Williams about?
The most important thing we're putting forward in this forthcoming election is our message of fairness. We think Britain is still a very unfair society,
mm-hmm.
and we'd start addressing that by offering everyone £10,000 of tax-free income, which would benefit the poorest in society the most, and in order to make sure that people have a fair chance in life,
yep.
It's not just about income, we'd also put more investment into smaller class sizes,
okay.
and to give extra money.
Okay, okay, well, thank you very much, Stephen Williams, for your time, and it was brilliant to interview you, and of course, best of luck in the coming election.
Okay, thanks very much.
And thank you very much to Stephen Williams there, the Liberal Democrat MP for Bristol West in Westminster. Malcolm Greaves' Honeyed Tones, once again, this week is reading another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. The Law of Trespass. I am not a lawyer, and I do not know how the law of trespass should work. But I do know something of how it does, or rather doesn't, work in rural districts, which perhaps is much more important. Quite frankly, my experience is that it works, or doesn't work, always in favour of the people who neither own nor rent any land save their own house and garden. Apparently, to prosecute for trespass with any hope of success, you have to prove that the trespasser has done some damage. To do this is very often most difficult. All such damage is cumulative. Each trespasser does a minute amount, and in time some appreciable harm is done to the owner or occupier of the land, who, if he were to prosecute all the perpetrators, would have to sue 1,000 people at least. Let us take the case of a town council which erects seats along the roadside in the pleasant walks on the outskirts of the town. Everybody admits that this is a capital thing to do. Sometimes one of these seats is placed against the wire fence of a pasture. On some fine sunny afternoon, a mother and her children go for a walk. They arrive at the seat. Mother sits down to her knitting, while her children climb through the fence to pick daisies. Are they doing damage? Yes, a little. Is it any good to prosecute? No, the farmer will be laughed out of court. Presently, the children discover that they can climb onto the wire fence and go jiggity jiggity jig. This is great fun. Again, are they doing damage? Yes, quite a lot. Is it worthwhile to prosecute? It would be a waste of time. But continue the story a little farther, and around that seat the fence gets weaker and weaker until one night the farmer's cows get out and possibly get into some gardens or allotments on the other side of the road. What happens then? Why, every man, woman and child in the town knows that the law of the land is that every man shall fence against his own cattle, and that the farmer is liable for the damage done by his trespassing cows. Of course, this is an extreme case, and the majority of trespassers do little harm. But there is always the risk that they may do a lot, quite unwittingly. Generally, the farmer's best course is to look the other way at most of it, and come down heavily on any wanton, deliberate damage when he gets the chance. After all, this happens but seldom. Most people do not realise that they are doing damage by trespassing. This is most noticeable with regard to grass.
Most folk seem to have an inherent respect for arable crops, but none at all for grass. Of course, part of this respect for arable crops is due to the fact that most of them are bad walking, whereas grass is nice stuff to walk on. But in addition, most trespassers think that arable crops have a value, and that grass has none. I got very annoyed at this idea one spring, and determined to prosecute some trespassers who were making a track up the side of a new pasture. I told my wife of my intention one afternoon, and she inquired thoughtfully whether I was sure of my ground over this trespass business. But I was bent on trespasser catching that afternoon. So after seeing my wife safely off to town, I called Trinket, my retriever, and set out for the field in question. It's a long, narrow field, bounded on one side by a roughish flint road, which leads to a large wood. The field was not fenced, there being only a shallow bank between it and the road. I had but recently laid it down to grass, and although I admit the road was rough, I did not see why people should make a wide footpath up the side of my field. On my way up the hill, as I left the farm buildings, I noticed that the hedge in the home pasture had a weak place in it, where it bounds old Mrs. Goodridge's garden, obviously made the previous autumn by young Tom Goodridge getting through to pick mushrooms. I made a mental note to get it repaired on the morrow, and went on my way. When I arrived at the new grass field, I saw a track about 4 feet wide, running up the field parallel with the road, and I had decided to cut the crop for hay that summer. That settles it, I thought to myself. I'll prosecute everyone I catch at it this afternoon. I walked half the length of the field up the road and waited on the bank. First came two women. They left the road and walked up the field towards me. They were dressed in black, and each one was approximately 14 stone. One of them seemed vaguely familiar, and both were puffed with the uphill walk. As they passed, I asked them if they were aware that they were trespassing and also doing damage. "Lord," said the nearest, "be us?" "Yes," I said, "you should keep to the highway." "You're that, Betsy," she said to her companion. "My, look at 'em, all gritty and stony. Think of my poor old feet. You should keep Vicky Road in better fettle, mister." I told them that the road was not my liability, and asked for their names and addresses. "Betsy, we be for it." "Look'ee now, bain't you Maister Street? Can you mind Charlotte? Lord, I've a bathed 'ee many a time. You be growed into a fine chap. I can mind 'ee a crying for the sponge." It was indeed true. I could trace dimly in this huge woman the nursery girl of my childhood. Prosecution was out of the question. Can a man prosecute a woman who has bathed him in childhood, I ask you? We chatted amicably for a while, and I explained that I'd had a lot of trouble with trespassers and was trying to stop it. "Us won't do it no more. I'd be real glad to Azidi. Good luck to 'ee wi' your trespassing." When they were gone, I looked down the field. Children in charge of a girl of about 13 were straggling up the hill, all over the field, as if it were a public recreation ground. As they came near, I called them and asked their names. They all wept copiously. I began to feel a brute. However, it must be done, I thought, and turned to the biggest girl. "Now then, it's no use crying. Your names?"
"Mine be Mary Luther. He in short, Nixby."
Here she dissolved into helpless sobbing. It was hopeless. "Oh, get along," I said, "and in future keep to the roads." They trudged away, and I began to fill my pipe, becoming more and more convinced that this prosecuting business was rather a washout. As I put my pouch away, I noticed a man coming up the field, stopping every now and again to admire the view. "Right," I said, "I'll have one more shot." When he came opposite me, he stopped.
"Isn't it a perfectly topping day, sir?" he said, beaming at me.
"It is," I answered. "But Why do you walk on my field instead of on the highway? Well, he said, look at the highway. This is much nicer for walking. Quite, I said. But you realise that you are trespassing, of course. Trespassing, he said. Why, this field is grass. I would never dream of walking on a field which has a crop. My dear sir, I said, I spend a lot of money in sowing this field to grass. But I don't understand. Everybody walks on grass. That's what it is for. Grass isn't a crop. Oh, wasn't it? Grass is one of the most valuable crops the British farmer tries to grow. You know, that's awfully interesting, he said. I've often wondered why there was so much grassland in England. I never thought it had value as a crop. I thought it just growed, like Topsy. Anyway, I'm exceedingly sorry if I've done any damage, but I was under the impression that one could walk anywhere on grassland. It was beyond me. I let him go. Anyway, it was nearly tea time. The easiest way to settle the whole business would be to fence the field. Besides, the law of trespass was practically obsolete nowadays. When I got back, my wife greeted me in the hall. Well, dear, got a nice bag of trespassers? I've had a gorgeous time. Oh, before I forget, the cows have gotten into Mrs. Goodridge's garden this afternoon and eaten her spring cabbages. She wants 25 shillings, or she's going to have the law on me. The law of trespass didn't seem so frightfully obsolete, I thought. Still, there were crumpets for tea.
And thank you very much to actor Malcolm Greaves for that excellent reading of Hedge Trimmings. It's time once again, an absolute pleasure to introduce Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill, to read his poem. Hello.
Hello again, John.
How's things?
Fine, yes. I think, bearing in mind the date, mm-hmm. I thought we'd do love this week instead of the political stuff.
Okay.
This is a slightly unusual love poem. It's called Ode to Speed Dating. Sort of modern manifestation of romantic encounters. Ode to Speed Dating. Love is a fragile flower that may devour those who tease it, and many proffer insights in as to how is best to please it. Most see mating as a game, a frame of chains and hidden levers, where only fools play by the rules and use what tools they can to seize it. Some jokers offer chances of romances by speed dating, hoaxing stokers of the glances flying furtively to waiting hopeful clients now reliant on this form of tick-box gaming will accept this form of debt and wish to get a chance of baiting, a new connection, a quick inspection, a swift reflection on offers floating by facile smiles some other times and all the wiles of scribbled noting. Around the tables, the secret cables, the place enables the ego soaring as rapid scoring, hearts outpouring amidst their fantasies and gloating. And then the bell spells time to move, get in the groove, the next heart-rending, swift encounter, next disclosure, next assessment, next intending of the exposures, false disclosures, muddled romp with no sensation. The clock ticks on, there isn't long until the gong signals the ending. Some will deride this rapid ride, this quest for bride or chance connection. Condemn as crude and won't be wooed, avoid as lewd and fear infection. But who's to say what comes today will never stay and lack duration? So if it works, enjoy the perks, ignore the smirks and risk selection. In chance romance, in verbal dance, and quick advances of suggestions to meet again with calmer brain when fear is slain by love's digestions. And then to explore the need for more, cut to the core of secret longings. When need to sin and will to win will have the sting to pierce protections.
Oh, fantastic. I feel like a huge round of applause should go, but I don't think there's enough people here for that.
if people feel moved, they could rush off to Waterstones and buy a copy of the book, which is in the gallery. So they could give me a call on 966-5514 and order one directly.
Okay, and what is your book called?
The book's called Diamonds in the Desert.
Diamonds in the Desert by Mr. T. Cutter.
Thank you, John.
In all good bookshops right now. And here he is. Every week he thinks we've forgotten him, but of course we haven't. It's Jess Barks, and he's here to give us his What's On for this week.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. starting with Wednesday 17th of February, a Mastodon would be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £16 in advance. On to Thursday 18th of February, Howlin' Lord will be performing at the Thunderbolt on Bath Road in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance and £5 on the door. Into Friday 19th of February, and the Bon Jovi Experience will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and this week I feature Woody Guthrie. He was a singer-songwriter and also a folk musician who was considered a figurehead in the folk movement and a huge influence and inspiration to Bob Dylan as well as many other musicians. This is from the 3-CD box set American Folk Legend and is the track Jesus Christ.
Jesus Christ was a man that traveled through the land, hard-working man and brave. He said to the rich, give your goods to the poor, so they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man, a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave. He went to the preacher, he went to the sheriff, told them all the same, sell all of your jewelry and give it to the poor. So they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. When Jesus come to town, the working folks around believed what he did say. The bankers and the preachers, they nailed him on a cross and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Now the working people followed him around, sang and shouted gay. But the cops and soldiers nailed him in the air and they laid Jesus Christ in his grave. Well, the people held their breath when they heard about his death. Everybody wondered why. It was the landlord and the soldiers that he hired to nail Jesus Christ in the sky. This song was made in New York City of a rich man's and preachers and slaves. If Jesus was to preach like he preached in Galilee, they would lay Jesus Christ in his grave. Yes, Jesus was a man and a carpenter by hand, his followers true and brave. One dirty coward called Judas Iscariot has laid poor Jesus in his grave.
That was Woody Guthrie with Jesus Christ from the box set American Folk Legend. Staying with 19th of February, and the Sex Pistols tribute Pretty Vacant will be performing at the Victoria in 88 Victoria Road, Swindon. Doors open at 8:30 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. On Saturday 20th of February, Fat Man Swings will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Sunday 21st of February, Green 61 will be performing at the Carnation Tap in Clifton, Bristol. The gig starts at 4 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Thank you very much, Jeff. Well, that's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show. Thank you very much to the MP for Bristol West, Stephen Williams. Apparently, he was extremely busy lobbying, but he made time just for us. The studio guests we had this week were Charles Thompson and Peter Sines. Thank you very much for their both coming in and for their time. And don't forget, of course, if you're a documentary filmmaker, if you have any interest in these things, check out the Grierson Trust, G-R-I-E-R-S-O-N. Stick it in Google. Malcolm Greaves read Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. And we had music by local composers Howard Davidson and Diana Johnston. The features were by Anthea Page and Tony Gosling, and the poem was by Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Dialect Radio. What's on was by Jeff Sparks, and the studio engineers were Johnny Royden and Cam Moulton. The producer was Anthea Page, and I am John Peters Coleman, wishing you a very good week. Take care.
You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectsradio.co.uk.